creating a livable planet today on the world. I'm Marco Werman. The U.S. may no longer be leading the charge on climate change, but across the globe, people are still trying to make our planet a livable one. In India, this man began a beach cleanup on his hands and knees.
This ocean is mine. I spent my childhood here with this ocean.
Also, small business owners in Puerto Rico are losing employees to FEMA.
They're paying a lot of money. They need a lot of people to do the work. So it's like I can't compete with FEMA.
Plus, the brutal fight to retake the Iraqi city of Mosul from ISIS control.
Literally, it was street by street, home by home. In West Mosul, it was house by house battle.
That's all ahead today here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. Good to have you with us on this Tuesday, a day like any other if you pick up the newspaper. Russian trolling under investigation, Puerto Rico recovering, Iran recovering, Italy recovering from a historic loss in soccer. We'll get to all of that today on the show. What it shows you, though, is that it's a chaotic and confusing time in the world, not to mention here in the U.S. Who are we as a country, and where are we headed as a planet? If you want a snapshot of all that, just go to Bonn, Germany, and this year's Global Climate Summit. It's where two dueling delegations from the U.S. are vying for attention and influence. We begin today with reporter Daniela Cheslow.
The official U.S. delegation to the climate talks here in Bonn cuts a confusing profile. It's small and nearly invisible. Delegates refuse to talk on record. The team's office door is mostly closed. More than halfway through the two-week meeting, the only official U.S. event promoted fossil fuels as a solution to climate change, including a big push for so-called clean coal.
At Peabody, we believe that the path towards near zero emissions coal begins with high efficiency, low emissions power plants.
This is the first U.S. climate delegation under President Trump, who has promised to pull out of the Paris Agreement that's the centerpiece of these talks and to restore the U.S. coal industry to its former glory. But it's not the only delegation or message from the U.S. here. There's another group loosely assembled under the banner We Are Still In.
We have oyster fishermen in my district, and they're being hit, you know, firsthand. They're experiencing the effects of climate change through, you know, the water is getting warmer. We're seeing bacteria come in that were never there before.
That's Josh Cutler, a state house representative from Massachusetts. I meet him and his colleague Jim Cantwell when they just arrived, straight from the airport, and they are putting on their carefully chosen ties.
The U.S. Capitol, cherry blossoms. See?
This one's got our seal of Massachusetts, so we're distinguishing ourselves because both in policy and in tie wear.
They want to make it clear where they're from and who they claim to represent, but they're a little nervous about how they'll be received.
These are all climate change leaders. What I dread is people saying, are you retrenching? Are you the only country in the world that's not going to follow the Paris Accord?
Cutler and Cantwell are among more than 100 American governors, mayors, and others who came to Germany to say they're still committed to Paris. One of their leaders is California Governor Jerry Brown.
So the rest of the world's got to carry the ball while we're temporarily over there in America off to the sidelines. But there's still California, there's still New York, Washington, Oregon, all these other places.
To make that message clear, Brown and former New York City Mayor Michael Bloomberg announced they have gathered support for climate action from public officials and business executives who represent 130 million Americans. Just how much ground they can make up remains to be seen. The federal government isn't just walking away from its Paris commitments, it's actively moving in the other direction. And when they do talk, the official delegation makes it clear who's in charge. I managed to nab White House Energy and Environment Advisor George Banks as he walked to a coffee bar, and I asked him what he thinks of the other team from the U.S. here.
They say they represent 130 million Americans.
Well, I represent like 300-something million Americans, right? Yeah, I do.
In other words, he says he speaks for the whole country. You wouldn't know that standing in the sprawling headquarters of the alternative U.S. delegation. Bloomberg sponsored it. It's six inflatable white domes. Over the weekend, hundreds of people packed in to hear him speak about American climate policy.
If Washington won't lead, mayors, governors, CEOs, and civil society will.
Like President Trump himself, this center projects confidence and even a swagger. After Bloomberg's speech, I meet Nadia Hmeti, a Moroccan activist.
It's big. It looks like America. Even the piece of cakes are big.
In fact, everything in this center is so big and flashy, she says at first she thought it was sponsored by Trump. I tell her it was a private initiative.
So this is not the government, the American government who is making this. It's this businessman.
Yeah.
Okay. It's nice for him.
Wait, what do you mean?
I mean, it's worth every penny to have this space because you have made something special. Your government said no, and somebody else said, I'll be in. So if you do it, let's do it the biggest way so everybody talks about it.
For The World, I'm Daniela Cheslow, Bonn.
Climate change is the biggest challenge in confronting our relationship with the rest of the natural world, but not the only one. Humans are deforesting the planet. We're causing massive extinction of other species. We're changing the basic chemistry of the oceans. And according to a warning just issued by more than 15,000 scientists from more than 180 countries, time is running out to protect the natural systems that provide for us. The document ends with a reminder that Earth, with all its life, is our only home. It is with that very message in mind that we are making a big change here at The World. We're saying goodbye to our environment desk and hello to something new, our livable planet desk. Deep in all of this, our longtime environment editor, Peter Thompson, along with our environment reporter, Carolyn Beeler. Peter, why the need to reframe our coverage of the environment?
Well, you know, Marco, I've been on this beat for more than 25 years, longer than I care to remember. And I've actually always been frustrated with this term, environment. I just felt like it doesn't capture what we do, which is really about our relationship with this planet. It's about, you know, what do we need? How do we use this place? How are we changing it? How are those changes coming back to haunt us? And there is a huge amount of stuff that's kind of squeezed into this one term that all makes it sound kind of abstract and external, like it's something outside of us that we can worry about at our leisure rather than really acknowledging that it's intimate in everything we do, every breath we take. And at the same time, the word environment has become a lot more polarized in this last quarter century that I've been covering it. And of course, that concern really exploded a year ago with the presidential election, which exposed and to some degree deepened these chasms in our society. And I think it's our role as journalists not just to explore those divisions, but to try to create room for dialogue. And getting rid of the term environment, I'm hoping, will help open things up a little bit, not have it be such a flashpoint where some people say, well, if it's environment, I disagree. Or if it's environment, I agree. I'm with you. And not even really listen.
And yet, Carolyn Beeler, that's what it feels like. It feels like the environment is so divisive. And you're out there on the ground reporting this stuff. You've encountered the divisiveness. How do you cover environmental stories without them being so divisive?
We're not going to stop covering the things that have become politically divisive, like policy debates about climate change. But we are going to increasingly focus on the fact that the environment is not something outside of us, like Peter said. It's something that impacts every day, every moment of our lives. So it's the quality of the air we breathe on our way to work. It's where we get our food and our clothes and how that impacts the world. The environment is driving huge global trends like migration of people. So we hope to acknowledge that the environment is really part of everything that we do all the time and tell stories about that.
So hopefully with this new frame for what we do, the conversation is going to be a little more inclusive, maybe aspirational. You know, what do we want rather than what are we fighting over? And again, which is not to say we're not going to deal with conflict. I mean, that's inevitable, of course. But hopefully the new frame will suggest that we're approaching these conflicts a little differently. And hopefully also it'll help evoke better that relationship that I was talking about earlier. It's about us. It's about the planet, a place we all share, and where we'll succeed or fail as a sustainable society. You know, I hope we succeed. I hope we live. And I think that's something that most of us can agree on. So let's start there. What do we need to make that possible?
So the livable planet. Carolyn Beeler, what do you hope we get out of this new perspective?
I hope we all realize to a greater extent that the environment isn't something that's out there when we want to go for a hike in it. It's something that's impacting all of our daily lives every day.
All right, Peter, what's in the pipeline? What are the first stories?
Well, in the next few weeks, we got a bunch of stories about kids who are at the front lines of climate change, from Chile to Florida. We've got stories about Germany's complicated relationship with coal. Later this week, an American climate scientist who left her world here at home and moved to Fiji to work among a community that's really at the very front line of climate change. But we're going to start today with a story that's actually about a beach cleanup, but it's not quite what you'd expect. It's actually got a little magic in it, which is what I love about it.
Editor Peter Thompson and reporter Carolyn Beeler of our new rebranded Livable Planet Desk. Thanks very much. And here we go with that story from Chavi Suchdev in Mumbai.
Mumbai has 72 miles of coastline. Some of it is covered in mangroves and some of it is beach, but none of it is clean. I live just off of one of its beaches, and I have to explain, this is not like Malibu or Manchester by the Sea or even Coney Island. It's so littered that running for exercise is for the real diehards. It's an obstacle course. Of course, there are cows and crows and stray dogs, but there are also a gazillion plastic bags, wrappers, shoes, bottles.
Plastic wrappers, chocolate wrappers, plastic bottles.
Yeah, there are biscuit wrappers too.
Here's your 2-minute Maggi noodle pack.
These guys aren't just doing a survey. They're actually on their hands and knees, thankfully wearing gloves, and they're shoveling this trash out of the sand. They're here because of one man who's basically tackling the trash problem head on.
I'm an ocean lover, beach cleaner.
Afroz Shah is a constitutional lawyer during the week, and 2 years ago he moved to a beautiful apartment with a view of the ocean near Mumbai's Versova jetty.
There was 5.5 feet of plastic at one end of the beach. It had piled up, piled up, piled up. So then I said I must do something.
That something translated to getting down on his knees to pick trash off the 2 miles of public beach he can see from his windows. Since October 2015, he's been clearing trash for 4 hours every weekend in what the United Nations has called the world's biggest beach cleanup ever. His efforts have inspired others. On this weekend, Shah is on the beach with 300 other people, and there is a lot going on.
So when it's on top, the top layer, you just use your hands or whatever implements you have, put it into the plastic buckets we have, and then load it onto the tractor, and then it is taken to one corner of the beach. From there, the local municipality picks it up.
Around me, small groups are digging up garbage and loading up trash. I can hear Gujarati, Hindi, Marathi, English, Tamil, Urdu, Russian, and there are some people from Norway and the UK and Japan. There are kids from the nearby slum, volunteers from the neighborhood mosque, soldiers, consultants, teachers, and college students. Disha is 15. She's barefoot in the muck, hauling out a bag. She comes to the beach partly because it's fun to hang with her friends, but also because it makes her feel good to be doing something altruistic.
Where I live, there used to be a bin, but the authorities have removed it because no one was using it. People bagged their trash and dumped it in the gutter around it. Even we used to throw it in the ocean.
Don't people know that what you put in will come back?
No, it's done, it's over, it'll go into the water. People think it'll go in the water, it won't come back, and the water will take care of it.
She tells me that since coming to the beach cleanup, she doesn't litter anymore. In fact, she puts packages and wrappers in her pocket until she finds a dustbin and tells others to do the same. There's also Shailesh, a 31-year-old fisherman who's manning the drinking water station for the volunteers. Shailesh deals with the trash every single day in his work. He says 2 years ago, all the fishermen were finding more plastic than fish in their nets.
It's made a difference. Yes, of course. When we went to catch fish, we used to find so much trash in our nets. See the fishery boats. Mine is also there. Now there is much less trash in our nets.
He says the fishermen used to dump the plastic from their nets right onto the beach, but now they all clear it up so it won't go back in with the tide. They seem to get it's their problem to fix. But that's not true for everybody. There are plenty of people who ask Afroz Shah why he doesn't just complain to the city about the trash. It's the government's job to clean up, after all. He says he thought about it. He is a constitutional lawyer. But then he decided, no.
This ocean is mine. I spent my childhood here. I have a special connect with this ocean. Me as an individual, I'm equally bound to protect the environment.
And every day, Shah gets emails from people all over the country who tell him how he's inspired them, which makes him happy.
And to all this, you know, this whole question about world's largest beach cleanup, thousands of volunteers, to tell you the fact, for me, it's a very personal journey. I started the cleanup. I will continue doing the cleanup. I tell all my volunteers, if none of you all will be there, you will still me standing, because I have to do my personal stuff for this planet.
For The World, I'm Chavi Sachdev in Mumbai.
I'm Marco Werman, and this is The World. As was grimly expected yesterday, the death toll has continued to rise from Sunday's earthquake near the border between Iran and Iraq. Authorities in Iran now say more than 500 people were killed there and thousands more were injured. When you hear about a disaster like this, one of the first thoughts many of us have is, how can I help? But sending aid to Iran from here in the U.S. is not as straightforward as you might think. In fact, it's pretty complex. The world's Shirin Jafari has been looking into this. So why is it so complicated to make donations to Iran?
Well, Marco, it's because of the sanctions that the U.S. government has imposed on Iran. Someone asked me today, didn't the Iran nuclear deal lift all the sanctions? The answer is no, it didn't. There are still a host of sanctions in place, including some that prohibit trade and business with Iran.
So if I'm looking to donate money to earthquake victims, what can't I do? Like, how do the sanctions limit what I can and can't do?
I called up Trisha Parsi to ask about this. He's with the Iranian American Council in Washington, D.C. They're an advocacy group that focuses on issues related to the Iranian American community.
You cannot send money directly. You can even not send it to a foreign NGO in Iran. So if you go to the British Red Crescent or something like that, that's also not permissible.
Okay, I get, Shirin, that these sanctions are still in place, but this was a major earthquake. Isn't there an exception for something like this?
There are exceptions. You can send money to an American NGO that's active in Iran and is only involved with humanitarian aid. These organizations, Marco, have special licenses from the U.S. government, which then allows them to operate in Iran without violating U.S. sanctions. Individuals can also apply for these licenses. The Department of Treasury issues them, but it's not easy. Here's Parsi again.
There's a tremendous amount of scrutiny that takes place, and there's some very, very specific rules that you have to follow, and the process itself can take you quite some time.
So not realistic when you're trying to reach people in a rush right after an earthquake.
Yeah, but as we're about to hear, this is not the first time a major earthquake has hit Iran, and the sanctions have been in place for a while. What happened in previous earthquakes?
Yeah, there are a couple of instances in the past where the U.S. has fast-tracked the process of issuing these licenses to help with earthquake relief. The last one was in 2012 when the Obama administration expedited these applications. Before that, in 2003, during the Bush administration, there was a really devastating earthquake that hit the city of Bam in southeast Iran.
I remember that, yeah.
Yeah, and about 26,000 people died, Marco, back then. The U.S. sent in military cargo planes that carried American search and rescue teams, medical supplies, and so on. And these were the first U.S. military planes to land in Iran, Marco, after 20 years. So that was really interesting.
So there was an exception at one point. How likely is it that something like this will happen this time?
Parsi says given the current political climate in the U.S., it's unlikely that something like this happens again. He told me he hears from Iranian Americans and others who want to help out, but they're just too afraid to break the law.
People are very upset that this is the current law, that you actually may end up violating sanctions, which could throw you into jail if you just try to help people who have had their lives devastated by an earthquake.
So, Shirin, as to what people here in the States can do to help Iranians in the wake of this earthquake, where can we go? What are those organizations that we can get money to that will get it to Iran?
We'll post the link, Marco, on our website, PRI.org, and people can find organizations that are vetted and do not break U.S. sanctions law.
The world's Shirin Jafari, thank you so much for this.
Thanks, Marco.
Iran has been struck by several major earthquakes in recent years, like the one in Bam in 2003, which killed more than 26,000 people. I asked Nathan Nimi what makes Iran so prone to seismic activity. He's a professor of geological sciences at the University of Michigan.
Iran is surrounded by plate boundaries on almost all sides. So the western side where the earthquake happened is the Arabia-Eurasia collision. There's deformation along the southern margin of Iran, and then in the north, where it's colliding with the Caspian Sea plate near Tehran. So this kind of ring of deformation around much of Iran is what causes there to be many earthquakes.
That seems like a really big area with so many plates at play. Is there any country in the world that has the same kind of geologic dynamic?
Turkey is another one. India, the northern margin of India, is very active, as well as countries like Nepal and Bhutan that lie right along the Himalayan plate boundary. But overall, there's a zone of deformation that extends from Europe all the way across the southern edge of Asia, which is very, very active tectonically.
Can you explain the zone of deformation? What does that mean?
In the cycle of plate tectonics, continents split apart and ocean basins form, and then those ocean basins close and the continents collide together again. There used to be an ocean basin that existed all along the southern margin of Europe and Asia. That's been closing over the last 50 million years. So Africa is currently colliding with Europe, which creates the Alps and the Carpathians. Arabia is colliding northwards with Central Asia, which creates the Caucasus Mountains and the Zagros Mountains. And then India is colliding northwards with Asia, creating the Himalayan Mountains. And so this zone, all the way across the southern margin of Asia, involves the collisions of continents, which builds mountains and leads to tectonic activity and earthquakes.
Obviously very, very slow collisions, but collisions all the same. I mean, to survive an earthquake, we're told to find, if you're in a house, find a door frame or some load-bearing wall. I suspect that the injuries suggest that there are lots of single-story homes in this part of Iran with few load-bearing walls or frames.
Yeah, well, you bring up a very important point, and that comment, which is, I think, kind of European and North American specific, is that the common building mode is wood-framed houses. In this part of the world, most buildings are going to be built with stone or masonry, not with wood.
Right.
And very few of them will actually have reinforced concrete with, you know, steel supports inside of them. And so they're very prone to collapse. This is, again, very similar to what we saw in the Haiti earthquake. Building with concrete but without rebar, these are very susceptible to collapse when the ground starts to shake. And unfortunately, you have significantly greater casualties as a result.
Is there any way for Iran to predict when the next quake will be, or to prepare anyway for the next quake?
Prepare, I think the answer is yes. Improving building codes is the biggest thing they could do, particularly cities like Tehran, where they're building lots and lots of high-rise buildings. It's a massive megacity. And if those huge buildings start to collapse, the devastation would be incredible.
As far as prediction, I mean, the science of predicting earthquakes, it's pretty sketchy, isn't it?
I think when we say the word prediction in terms of thinking about a weather prediction, what's going to happen tomorrow, yes, we don't have that kind of ability. We can use things like GPS receivers in scientific studies to ask questions about how quickly the ground is deforming, and from that make a hazard assessment. What's the likelihood that there will be a large earthquake? And there is information of that type for Iran and for many active plate boundaries around the world. We know it's risky around Tehran, parts of central Iran less so. And so those are the kind of things that we can suggest where building codes should perhaps be the strongest or most enforced. But in terms of predicting what might happen tomorrow or next week or next month, we're nowhere close to being able to do that with earthquakes.
Nathan Neme, professor of geological sciences at the University of Michigan. Thank you very much.
Great. Thank you very much.
You're with the world. I'm Marco Werman. For the first time in six decades, Italy's soccer team won't be headed to the Men's World Cup. How's that feel?
When you fall from the stars, the heat is much heavier and painful.
Plus, what Attorney General Jeff Sessions now remembers about contacts with Russia. That's all still ahead right here on The World. I'm Marco Werman, and you're with The World. We're a co-production of the BBC World Service, PRI, and WGBH here in Boston. Attorney General Jeff Sessions was back in the hot seat today in Congress, and he wanted to set the record straight on his previous appearance there, in which he testified about interactions between the Trump campaign and Russia.
My answers have not changed. I've always told the truth, and I have answered every question as I understood them to the best of my recollection, as I will continue to do today.
Sessions told members of the House Judiciary Committee that he now remembers a meeting in March 2016 that was also attended by George Papadopoulos. He's a former foreign policy advisor to the Trump campaign who pleaded guilty to lying to the FBI about his contacts with Russian officials.
But I have no clear recollection of the details of what he said at that meeting.
Sessions said he would have mentioned this meeting in his previous testimony on the Hill if he had recalled it, but he told lawmakers that his days working for the Trump campaign were, quote, chaos from day one, and that he cannot be expected to have a perfect memory of those hectic days.
I have been asked to remember details from a year ago, such as who I saw on what day, in what meeting, and who said what to when. In all of my testimony, I can only do my best to answer your questions as I understand them and to the best of my memory. But I will not accept and reject accusations that I have ever lied. That is a lie.
The Attorney General was also asked about other matters at today's hearing, but the focus was mostly on the allegations of possible collusion between Russia and the Trump campaign. Trump's former campaign manager, Paul Manafort, was indicted last month, part of the first wave of criminal charges to come out of special counsel Robert Mueller's investigation. Manafort is now under house arrest and wearing a GPS ankle monitor because he's considered a flight risk. The charges against him, including money laundering and conspiracy, were obviously big news here in the U.S., but also in Ukraine. Manafort made millions there as a consultant to former Ukrainian leader Viktor Yanukovych, who fled to Russia in 2014. Reporter David Stern has been following this from the Ukrainian capital, Kiev. Just remind us what was already known about Paul Manafort's connection to Viktor Yanukovych. What did he do to advise the former president of Ukraine?
Manafort had a long and extensive relationship with Yanukovych dating back to just after the Orange Revolution. I think he came on around 2005. But the most important thing was that he revived, you could almost say, created from, you know, the ashes, Yanukovych's political career. Yanukovych, if you remember, in the Orange Revolution was the losing party. He was defeated after these street demonstrations and his political life was basically seen as over. Manafort turned him around, made a new politician out of him, made him much more, I guess you could say, viewer and listener friendly. And he ended up eventually becoming the president. And Manafort was advising him in the campaigns all that time, but he also eventually became a political advisor as well.
So Manafort's a political operative. He's done these makeovers for a number of politicians around the globe over the years. What are the allegations that involve his time in Ukraine? Like, did anything come as a surprise to Ukrainian investigators looking into Yanukovych?
Well, he's not accused of anything in Ukraine, but he's involved in two cases here that the Ukrainians are obviously looking into. The first one, and it's much more broad, is the so-called case of the Black Ledgers. These are hundreds of pages of handwritten entries that were discovered at Yanukovych's party. It's called the Party of Regions, at their headquarters. And Manafort's name appears in 22 lines of these ledgers. He allegedly received close to $13 million that people say could have been off the books illegal payments. Now, as I say, he's not actually charged with anything, but the Ukrainian investigators are interested in speaking to him because obviously he may have some insight into the other entries in these black ledgers and whether or not these were indeed illegal payment. The other case, if you remember, Yanukovych in 2011 jailed his main opponent, a woman named Yulia Tymoshenko, who was previously the prime minister. Manafort helped set up a report that was written by an American law firm known as Skadden Arps. Now, what came as a surprise to the Ukrainian investigators was they had a suspicion that Skadden Arps was paid much more than the fee that was originally named, which is around $12,000. What came out of the indictment of Manafort in the United States was that they were possibly paid $4 million, obviously a lot more. And so the question is this true? And where did that money come from?
So what are the next steps for investigators in Ukraine?
The main issue for them, as far as Manafort is concerned, is to talk to him. And that has proven to be quite a hurdle for them. They originally put in a request with the Justice Department. They would like to speak to him as a possible witness or as a party with information. This has not come together. There's not a whole lot they can do on the Manafort front until they actually speak to him.
What is Manafort's reputation in Ukraine? Like, how are Ukrainians reacting to all this news?
Well, Manafort, I guess you could say here in Kiev, the cradle of the revolution, he's seen very much as the enabler, the spin doctor, you know, perhaps even the, you know, the evil genius behind the throne that helped bring Yanukovych to power. There was generally, among at least the political class here, a feeling of triumph or jubilation that his day in court may come. They see him as the man who was responsible, you know, if not entirely, at least played a major role in bringing Yanukovych to power.
Is Ukraine planning to help Special Counsel Robert Mueller? What effect could all this have?
The Ukrainians kind of find themselves in a difficult position. On one hand, they have said that they will help. In fact, the Prime Minister, Vladimir Groysman, not too long after the indictment, said that they would offer any help, but the Americans had not asked for help yet. And obviously, they have to say that. You know, nobody's going to come out and say, don't even bother giving us a call. But they have to be careful because, obviously, the Trump administration sees this case against Manafort as a concerted attack on them. And so the Ukrainians don't want to do anything to make the Trump administration think that they're working with Trump's enemies. That obviously is going to be at the back of their mind. If if a request does come through from the FBI.
Reporter David Stern in Kiev, thank you very much.
Thank you.
There are many threads to Russia's meddling in the U.S. election. Here's one that's been getting a lot of attention.
New revelations today about the role of social media giants like Facebook and Twitter.
Tonight, Facebook revealing that 80,000 posts from Russian-backed Facebook accounts reached potentially a third of all Americans.
We're getting new information at this hour on what these ads were, how specific they were, who they targeted. These are the crucial questions.
One Russian journalist is responding to that coverage in a tongue-in-cheek way.
I wanted to see how many people I can really influence with an ad paid for with Russian rubles on Facebook.
Alexei Kovalev created a fake Facebook group called Russians for Common Sense and then created an ad through that page. The catch line from that ad, "This is our message to you, dear Americans. Please chill." Kovalev says he targeted Americans of all ages with different interests.
From gun rights to pro-life to Bill O'Reilly to Barack Obama, and well, anything I could really think of.
And so to reach those Facebook users here in the U.S., you did what a Kremlin-linked troll farm has been accused of doing, using targeted ads on Facebook. How much did you pay?
There was 1,770 rubles, which is about $30.
All right, $30. And how many people were you able to reach?
This is where it's getting really murky. So Facebook tells me that I managed to reach 4,196 people. But that figure probably doesn't really mean anything. As far as I can tell, reach on Facebook really means that those people could probably see my ad on Facebook. Most of them, like the overwhelming majority, shrugged and scrolled on.
Right.
And about a couple of dozen of them engaged with my post, as in liked it, shared it, or commented.
So 4,196 pairs of eyes. Your ad went by those eyes. But you have 22 likes, 22 followers. So that's how many people you were able to reach. I mean, I can see how a group around like American Muslims, which was one of the fake groups that was posted on Facebook a while ago, how that would bring in American Facebook followers. But who in the United States would kind of like or follow a group called Russians for Common Sense?
I could have probably come up with a catchier name, but I thought Russians in the headline would really suffice. In a way, it did.
Beyond trying to get an enormous reach with your ad on Facebook, was there any truth in kind of the position you were stating, that Americans, as far as this Russian trolling business, you just need to chill out?
Yeah, that was my point, and which I'm trying to get across on my Twitter feed and elsewhere in my articles, that there's a significant, let's put it diplomatically, there's a significant degree of overstatements in all those headlines in a way that what I saw with my own ad is that they are clearly exaggerating the effect that these political ads by Russian trolls were having.
The FBI, CIA, and the NSA all concluded there's evidence that Russians tried to affect the outcome of the election, not to mention the extensive reporting from the Russian business magazine, RBC. And you still think we Americans should chill?
I definitely think so. I mean,
would you chill if the tables were turned?
let's look at it realistically. I mean, I saw headlines that said 120 million Americans were exposed to Russian propaganda ads on Facebook. But can you say that 4,196 people were exposed to a Russian hoax on Facebook? I mean, how many of those people did even register my ad in their eyesight? Did they even pay any attention to it, or did they just scroll through it and never even noticed its appearance on their Facebook feed? That we can never know.
I mean, the thing is, we do know that those Russia-linked Facebook pages did bring in hundreds of thousands of followers. How do you think the actual trolling story should be covered?
I don't know. It's probably less exaggeration, but then again, it wouldn't...
That's assuming that the story is being exaggerated.
Yeah, we are working in an environment, in a ruthless, unforgiving market that's failing on many fronts. And we are in a constant race for more clicks. We have to write more attention-grabbing headlines. And at some point, any truth that might have been there simply evaporates. And all we've left with is fake news, but Kremlin trolls aren't responsible for that.
So you see a correlation between the race for clicks and the rise of fake news?
Yes, definitely.
Yeah, I think I can agree with you on that one. We'll leave it there. Russian journalist Alexei Kovalev speaking with us from Moscow. Thank you.
Thank you.
Our colleagues at the BBC have more than 25 different language services, and many of the reporters for those language services regularly put themselves in harm's way to get a story, like Nafise Konivard of the Persian service. As Iraqi troops retook the city of Mosul from ISIS this past summer, Nafise was right there with them.
Literally, it was street by street, home by home. In West Mosul, it was house by house battle.
She spoke with David Aminor, host of the BBC's Fifth Floor podcast.
During the time you were embedded with the army, you were very close up to the action. What is it like being a journalist in that situation?
I remember the time that we were on helicopter over Mosul. It was one of the things that when we were done, we said that, okay, we are crazy. In some point, you start telling yourself that, what we have done? Because we took that helicopter's doors off after insisting to let me into that helicopter and take those doors off because they were telling us bullets will come in. And this is not really acceptable. But I said that, okay, we cannot film.
Are you serious, Nafise? Are you serious?
Yes.
You put the camera before the bullet.
But in some point, you start thinking that you want to tell a story and you need to have great, good picture. I'm joking that, okay, we really pushed too hard, but in some point, I'm serious because we pushed so hard because we knew that we are the only one had access to this. And there are things that we should show, especially the use of human shields, which we documented in that trip. Literally, we documented for the first time. We got pictures that...
And those were the pictures you got from the helicopter.
Yes, exactly. It was that. And in some point, you start thinking that it was pushing and also taking risk. But when you finish, you start thinking about all those moments that you could hear bullets coming up. In one point, I was really was thinking that what we are doing. But when we did that, we saw the impact and we were happy that we did that because just 1 week later, one of those helicopters with two very young and lovely pilots shot down by ISIS.
Amid the horrors, any particularly uplifting moments for you?
Many, but let me tell you about the moment that one of soldiers that was from Mosul himself. And he was parted from his family for 2 years, more than 2 years. He was contacting his mother to find out when she's coming out. And that moment that he saw his mother and start kissing her feet and her hands, and he couldn't just stop crying. And it made us cry. These tears will come out because of happiness, because you could see that also good things is happening. Despite all disasters, there was some good moments like this.
Nafise Konivard of the BBC's Persian service. She was speaking there with my colleague David Aminor, host of the Fifth Floor podcast. 55 days since Hurricane Maria turned off the lights in Puerto Rico. What is it like trying to operate a small business on the island? That's what Kayvon Antonio Hedari wondered. He's a journalist based in Miami who has family in Puerto Rico, and he spent the past 10 days on the island, traveling around, talking to small business owners who are trying to adapt and survive in a place where electricity is definitely not a given these days. Kayvon says having access to a generator is a make-or-break proposition for many local entrepreneurs.
Those businesses that don't have access to power, either because their neighborhood wasn't reconnected or they didn't have the money to buy a generator or had one on hand, then they have an uphill struggle.
Did you come across any solar projects, any solar generators?
Absolutely. There's people who are trying to get microgrids of solar generators, but with contradictory government guidelines and decrees, they can't get them out of the port.
Why can't they get them out of the port?
Because the government said, we're not going to charge excise tax on them, and then all of a sudden, they do want excise tax on these things. And I was just talking with somebody, you know, he bought some in L.A., had them shipped, and he can't get them out of the port here without... getting a greatly increased cost and set it up for solar panels on his house.
And if you don't have money for a generator, will you find friendly businesses that will allow you to tap some of their energy?
Yeah, it's sort of rolled back the clock about 60 years where you have to depend on your neighbor. Communications are face-to-face. Phones don't work in many parts of the island because cell phone towers have been knocked down and out. I was in the mountains this weekend and the weekend before, and a lot of people don't have water. Some of them had the electricity come back, but it went out again last Thursday. The governor promised that power would be back by December for Christmas, which is a big sort of festive season in Puerto Rico. That's the tradition. But it's sinking in that things are obviously not happening as quickly as they'd hope. And people do share power, and some businesses have become sort of like a farmer's market. On a certain day, they all go outside under a covered area, and they sell from there. It's become more of a cash economy.
So you spoke with a woman named Aisha Tort. She owns a physical therapy clinic in San Juan. What did she tell you about how she's working with her patients?
Well, she's giving them treatment, and without a connection to the internet, she can't get access to the medical records to be able to bill. So basically, she's working on an IOU. We'll get paid later, but we're providing the services now philosophy.
Right. And I gather she's lost some part-time employees. I want us to hear her describing what her employees are going through.
One of them, she just quit because she needs more hours. She's going to move to work with FEMA because, of course, they're paying a lot of money. They need a lot of people. So it's like I can't compete with FEMA.
Wow. So she can't bill, and obviously, as she says, she can't compete with FEMA. How common is it that FEMA is undercutting businesses right now?
Well, right now, there seems to be an air of a feeding frenzy. And a lot of people are feeling that when FEMA has to stay and rebuild the island, it's going to be difficult to compete in terms of wages and budgets against what FEMA can do, because FEMA comes in and brings in a lot of people from out of town, and they pay the locals very handsomely.
So you spoke with another business owner, Waleed Garga, who has a small guest house like a B&B. He's not from Puerto Rico. How's he doing 5 weeks after the storm?
He's trying to recover by getting first the power, then the permits that allow him to run his B&B and allow him to book things again. A lot of people are actually renting parts of their house out to contractors, all kinds of things, but you have to accept that some people don't have power. Where I'm staying, there is no power. There is water, and it's not too far from the beach, and that never hurts.
You asked Mr. Garga why he chose to live in Puerto Rico and start a business there. Here's what he told you.
Why wouldn't you live in Puerto Rico? It's the best place on earth, what could I say? People are nice, the weather is awesome. I mean, I've been through more than 10 countries. I traveled a lot. Before I moved here, I was a UN officer. So, in fact, I was doing emergency interventions professionally, and this is how I know that the intervention is pretty slow now.
So, Kayvon, it sounds like he wants to stay on the Isla Encanto. What are his long-term plans?
His long-term plans are to try and get up in business before the tourist season kicks in and hold on and hope the ship rights itself so that he can continue operating.
Kayvon Antonio Hadari speaking with us from San Juan, Puerto Rico. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Finally today, the agony of defeat. That's the mood in Italy right now after the Italian national soccer team failed to qualify for the Men's World Cup next year. Yes, Italy. First time in 60 years that's happened. Italian fans are taking this unexpected elimination of the four-time world champs really hard. And for the world soccer guy, William Troop, it's personal.
The head of the Italian Soccer Federation perhaps saw this coming. Carlo Tavecchio said weeks ago it would be an apocalypse if Italy failed to qualify for the World Cup. He meant that in a reassuring way. But the apocalypse did happen yesterday in Milan. As the referee blew his whistle to end the match between Sweden and Italy,
it was like hearing the blow of death.
That's Italian journalist Tancredi Palmieri of BN Sport. He was at the San Siro Stadium in Milan last night.
The stadium went silent. Every Italian player walked through the mix zone with tears in eyes. Everyone except Buffon.
He means Gigi Buffon, the 39-year-old Italian goalkeeper, a World Cup winner in 2006, a legend of the sport who was playing, it turns out, the final game of his international career. Right after the match, Buffon went on live Italian TV to apologize to the fans. He didn't just have tears in his eyes. He full-on cried as he spoke. Just listen to the pain dripping from his voice.
Dispiace perché abbiamo fallito un qualcosa che anche a livello sociale poteva essere veramente importante e di conseguenza niente.
We failed, he said, when we could have been great. After that, Buffon walked past the media scrum, past Tancredi Palmieri.
He was walking in front of us and he was still crying. When you fall from the stars, the heat is much heavier and painful.
Italian fans everywhere are feeling that hit right now. And they blame one man above all, Italy coach Giampiero Ventura. They're calling him clueless, incompetent, and worse. Ventura could only muster this after his team was eliminated from the World Cup.
Scusa del risultato, assolutamente sì.
I'm sorry about the outcome, he said. Understatement of the year. Okay, full disclosure, I am one of those disillusioned Italy fans. Grew up in Italy, learned to play soccer there, still feel the passion every time the Azzurri take the field, and I root for them harder than I do for my native Mexico or my adopted U.S. But I suppose this does make it easier during the actual Men's World Cup next year. I won't have to choose. No Italy? The U.S. failed to qualify too? So it's simple. Vamos, Mexico!
Mi dispiace, the world's William Troop. Disappointed Italy fan today, but hopeful Mexico fan looking ahead to next year. That's our show today from the Nan and Bill Harris Studios at WGBH in Boston. I'm Marco Werman, back with you tomorrow.
PRI, Public Radio International.